Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
We are joined for the second time on this episode of Celeb Savant by Jethro Sheeran, who also goes by the professional name Lone Star. He is a British musician, music producer, rapper, and is based in Denmark. He is a number one Billboard and multi-award winning artist who has collaborated with several famous musicians, including Tupac, Chris Brown, Lil Wayne, Macy Gray, Akon, DaBaby, and many more. Jethro is the first cousin of Ed Sheeran, as their fathers are brothers and they have written and produced songs together. In this episode of Celeb Savant, we'll be catching up with Jethro and finding out what's been happening in his world since we last spoke. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Jethro, Lone Star Sheeran. Where do we find you in the world and how are you doing?
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure. I am in Denmark at the moment. In my hometown now, called Kundbu. It's about 40 minutes north of Copenhagen. And this is where I reside with my little dogs here. This is Frida and Meggie. Yeah, I've been working here in Denmark on my new album in the studio at home for the minute. And I do kind of trips back and forward to London to record and work with engineers, musicians and other featured artists. So I've just been focusing on that, really, writing and staying home a lot. So it kind of feels a bit like lockdown because I'm in the countryside and I'm just kind of really focused on staying home and just working and kind of, yeah, working on the next project.
So tell us more about this project. Is it one you referenced in our previous interview?
Yes, actually is exactly that. So it's called A Waterfall Effect, and that's my intention on this album. It's 10 songs, with 11 songs would be with a bonus track. So I'd be releasing it back to back every week, and then the whole album together with a bonus track on the 11th week. It's slightly delayed because I've changed kind of the theme a bit of it. And it's all self-produced by myself. So I produced every song on the track. I've just got live instrument players to come. So when I program, say, some drums or a synth or piano, guitar, flute, anything, and I programmed it myself on the keyboard, I would get a flutist to come in that's going to take what I've written and just hopefully we can track it up so it's gives it a bit more body. But also sometimes I just let them have free range and they come up with something obviously similar, but they might tweak it slightly. And it usually, because they're the flutist and they're live, it sounds better. So I kind of steal a bit of their art, as it were, and use it on the album. So I'm really looking forward to it having a really strong kind of live instrument feel to it. So it's going to be very big and bright and anthemic. So that's the plan. I'm really proud of it. It's coming together. I mean, I've done 30 songs so far. You know, whittling it down to 10 with a bonus track as well. So I'm just kind of waiting for a spring release, basically. And then hopefully the three singles will be coming out in April, May, June, or May, June, July. Okay. That's the plan. Yeah.
So what was the original theme and what did you change it to and why was there a change?
Well, the original theme I felt was a bit more poppy. It had a bit more of a hip hop pop feel. It was a lot of female vocal hooks that were kind of about just having a good time. And even though the songs were brilliant for radio and it was really kind of commercially brilliant, I thought, because it still had an edge to it. It was like dirty pop, I like to say. That's what I call that style of music. It's like, you know, tough beats and gritty samples and kind of really cool lyrics and stuff like that. But it's like, it was more pop. But I've kind of gone down more of a darker sort of musical route where it's more, I'm doing this soundtrack for the Van Gogh new movie, which I mentioned. And just because I've been working on that, I've been producing a lot of kind of theatrically type film score music.
Yeah.
And it inspired me and I started writing more film scorey type stuff, hence all this live orchestral sound on the album now. And it just kind of made me think, like, what is the message I want to get across? Because this is kind of throwaway. It's great. It's timeless and it's kind of cool. But is there a message in the music to help other people, for other people to listen to and go, wow, this is like, I can relate to that? Or, you know, not just dancing and partying and having a great time or braggadocious sort of lyrics and stuff like that. So that was my main focus. It's a bit more spiritual. It's got religious elements in it. It's kind of got, a heaven, a hell, a darker light sort of thing. So it's kind of like I did an EP back in the day, one of my first, and it was called Isoface Light, which is an isoface light is, it's like a lighthouse. So it's the equal amount exactly of light and dark. So it flashes light. Black of light. So it's kind of like half the album's light with a spiritual kind of thing, you know, it's kind of heaven and the other half is quite dark. I wouldn't say hell, but it's kind of about the darker things in life and the pressures and the anxiety, fear, insecurities that we have as humans on this planet and what's happening. It's about raw human needs and a bit more about, it's a bit more emotional. It's a bit more, I think if people are going through something, they can relate to it. And it's kind of like a dark part of the album, but there's light at the end of the tunnel, so it's kind of hopeful.
Yeah.
So with all the strings and this oboe kind of sad crying kind of vibe, and there's rain samples in it, and it just kind of bling, you know, when the sun comes out after the rain.
Yeah.
That, or like the morning after a dark night, is that kind of feeling is what I want to get across. So it's it'll be quite a spiritual album for me now. So all the kind of singles that I've taken off, I'm still going to release, but I'll do it on a separate EP later. Okay.
You answered my question. So, I mean, they still can be released, but just in a different aspect. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely going to release them and maybe even do more of that style and make another album that's going to be, because I hate being pigeonholed, because I kind of produce, I rap, I do poetry, I do spoken word. I also sing, not very well, but I sing. And so it's like hard to pigeonhole me because I love all music. And I think it's the same. It reflects my life. Sometimes I'm happy. Sometimes I'm down. Sometimes you cry. Sometimes you laugh. So it's like, to be just like, you're one thing. You're only happy and laugh, and you only do pop music. Like, you're just Justin Bieber dancing and singing, you know, about love and things like that. I think I could do a classical album and then do a heavy metal album. Like, or not actually albums, but songs. I could do a classical with an operatic sample with a hip hop beat, then I could do a hip hop beat and just add some metal guitars, and it would be like a rap rock thing, and it would all fit on the same album, because it's all about, you know, laughter and pain and sadness, but also fun and laugh, you know, happy fun stuff. And that's what we do every day. You might wake up a bit pissed off, you trip over your toes, piss you right off, then you have a coffee, the sun comes out, and then you have a, you know, you feel better and you start to, you know, it's very mental health, this album.
I love that you mentioned pigeonhole. So when you receive that in your world, it's very different from someone in the music world or music space.
Yes.
So everyone sort of gets pigeonholed in their life. They are an accountant. They are this. They are in this box or that box. And the perception is, okay, cool. Well, they can't be anything more than that because that's what they is. So the picture I like to create is that a picture of an octopus. So each of us is the body of the octopus. And we each has as many or as little tentacles as we want. Brother, sister, sister, aunt, rap, dance, heavy metal, classical. But when you are just classified as the one in your world or your space, how do you respond, not really react, more respond to people or experiences where you are pigeonholed?
Do you know what? It's a great question because, well, firstly, it's brilliant that you use the octopus in that way, because I use it in business. I try and have 8 revenue streams like an octopus legs, and say one revenue stream dries up, we have lockdown, I can't do gigs anymore. Then I've got the streaming. So that's 2. And then I've got, you know, doing the different businesses. Like, I've got a Lone Star Coffee now, so I can work on that. And then I do a bit of crypto. So I try and have 8 things rolling. And then, you know, if there's 2 of the legs get cut off, you've still got 6 to work with until you can hang, you know. And then maybe one of the 6 businesses can help the other 2 businesses. And it's the octopus theory as well. So that's brilliant. But as far as pigeonholed, when I was younger and looking for a deal and wanting to be signed to a major label, and I was going into Universal and Warner and Sony and all these labels underneath them, it never really transpired into a record deal properly, because, you know, there was things back then that, oh, you're white, but you're a rapper. You're too old. You're too young. The things you rap about is too personal. Like, there's always something. So they just say, right, you do this. And they have a very clear idea of what they want. And if you don't do it, they'll just go to the next artist that will do it or can do it or is doing it. So it's always like a conflict between business and art, because this is me. And what I learned is just stick to your guns, like as an artist. And I just did me, and I just unapologetically, if you want to sign me, do it. If not, I'm going to do it by myself. And I ended up doing that. So I started my own label called Urban Angel Records.
Yeah.
And then the only person that can tell me I'm pigeonholed is myself. So I can wake up every day now. And this is the best thing to do for me, is I can choose to work or I can choose not to. I can choose to make a song or I can choose to go for a walk. Or I can choose to do my coffee. So I don't have a label with my diary, which people like Ed Sheeran, who I've seen his diary, and other artists that are signed at such a high level, they have a diary given to them. Right, you are doing this radio show on this day, and they're given this in January to start the year, and that you see that their only next day off is like Christmas Day a year later, sort of thing. So it's just, I would have done that, and I know a lot of friends that have signed to majors that have done that, that are in this kind of pop category, and not having that kind of over my head, having to be, you know, somewhere. It must be so anxious. Like, they must have so much anxiety, because what if you're sick, you know, and you're sold out a stadium in March? Like, say you've sold out three stadiums, 100,000 people. Then the day before, you get, you know, you have psychosis or you have a meltdown, or, you know, you're just, even stuff like flu and COVID or whatever. So, you know, and it's a risk, even if you're independent, of course, but at that sort of height and having this label, you know, they'll just come and send a doctor to your back room and inject you with some kind of cocktail of something, vitamin, you know, just to get through those gigs. And then a bit like Elvis, if you've seen that Elvis,
yes,
that's so true. So I would just, you know, I do focus more on the music and the releasing and streaming and downloads and things like that, even though downloads is not very big anymore, but it's still there, rather than gigs, because gigs cost money as well and energy. So I always find, like, even if I went to London next week and I did a gig and got paid, there's two flights, there's 3 days in a hotel, there's all the rehearsals, there's the band members that come with it. And I did one, a headline show in Cannes last summer, which I think we spoke about.
Yes.
And it was with a Danish band called Replica. We have a single, by the way, it's called Kingdom. Yes. Cheap. Thanks for that, Barrett. Yeah. So, and it was just seeing how much it costs, because you've got like five mouths to feed, five hotels.
Yeah.
So independent, you know, budget wise, it's difficult. And I just find it so much easier to work in the studio at home and then send it out. I farm all my music out for features, and then I send it to the States to Brent Colatalo, who's one of the best in the world at mixing and mastering, another guy, Chris. So Behringer. Yeah. So to answer your question, being pigeonholed, I find, is ridiculous, because, you know, your music should reflect yourself, and music's about the spirit. And if your spirit is feeling different things, the essence of life is changed. So we're changing all the time. So just to be singing love songs, it's kind of like you're kind of, yeah, I would never want to be that. I always kind of chop up my music. So when I release it, all my listeners and supporters are used to it. Oh shit, what could it be today? Is it going to be featuring Snoop Dogg on a sample that's from a classical song? And then, you know, he's done like hip hop drums that are old school from the 90s or something. So, or I do trap music with the opposite. I have Chris Brown singing on some kind of trap song with a haunting classical vocal, and you just don't expect it. So it's always worked for me. Excuse me.
Okay.
It's all about collaboration for me. So yeah, I think being pigeonholed is just not for me. And that's why this album is going to be such a melting pot of sounds, music and features and things like that. So, yeah, I just don't agree with it. But I do understand it as well, because if I was an A&R at a record label and someone said, hey, I do. It's the same. I know I'm using Ed as another example, but this is what I've been on. But when he was coming up, he was so difficult to pigeonhole, because, and they didn't want to do it with him at first, because he was at this club called Notting Hill Arts Club, and he did this big showcase, But it's a brilliant example because he was kind of this red-haired, scruffy young guy who rapped, he sang, he played guitar, he had a loop pedal, he beatboxed, and he did kind of, he was solo just on his own. And it was this whole kind of novelty kind of thing. And they were like, how do we put that on a record? Like the beatboxing, the, you know, so his first label wanted him to dye his hair from ginger to brown, only sing and play guitar. This is called Crown Management. And this is why he wrote the song, You Need Me, Man, I Don't Need You. And that is exactly because he wrote that for his management company then. They're like, you need me, I don't need you. And then he kept his hair ginger. He still sings. He still beatbox. He still yes. raps. He still loop pedal. And then he sold out Wembley Stadium 3 days in a row by doing that. So it's an incredible achievement. So, and he just didn't allow to be pigeonholed, even though he is kind of now pigeonholed as this pop artist. So it's just a good example because he's so awkward and strange and he's not your typical Justin Bieber with his abs out and his good looking face. And, you know, so he kind of broke the mold. But I think at that time there was Sam Smith, there was Adele, you know, Sam Smith being gay and kind of out there and kind of not, you know, people say he's a bit overweight or whatever, not your typical pop star. Then you've got Adele, who's not your typical pop star. Then you've got Ed, who's not your typical pop yes. star. So they all came in and it was like year of the nerd sort of thing,
yeah,
which is really cool. So it's they got a chance.
Which is good because I think society plays safe by pigeonholing people and allowing themselves to be pigeonholed because they know what to expect. They know what's coming up. It's just sort of a cog in the machine that's going.
This is the thing. You're so right. It's so easy to sell because if me and you went out for fish and chips, we want to get fish and chips. If we want to go to a Nike store, we want Nike shoes. So if you go to Ed Sheeran, you want a love song or a pop song. You don't go to Ed for a heavy metal concert. So I think that's why they like it. So you just kind of pigeonhole it, you sell it, that's your audience. And, you know, with someone like Ed, for instance, or James Blunt, or whoever, the singer, song, guitar, that's not so crazy. It's not, you know, massive hip hop, dark underground hip hop that's really cool, but you're only going to limit your audience. Whereas Ed's got people like aunties, uncles, grandmas, children, kids. And the thing is, most of the kids that like him that are young, they might be 10, 11. So they have to come with a parent. Then the mum takes them. Then the dad goes, oh, I'll come as well. Then the kid's elder brother has to go. So that's four people. Then the kid wants his friend to come. And then, so that's five tickets sold in one. Whereas a hip hop concert, you're not doing that.
Yeah.
You're just getting adults that like hip hop. But this is kind of like an experience and an all night out thing for the family. Yeah. So that's why I think those artists sell so well. And they are pigeonholed as this kind of family sound. You know, everybody likes a bit of Bieber or, you know, or whatever, rather than, you know, you know, Eminem wouldn't, even though he's hugely commercial and pigeonholed slightly in kind of pop rap, but you wouldn't find sort of a grandma really going to an Eminem concert as much as you would, as much as you would someone that's pop, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's why they do pigeonhole it, because they market it that way. It relates to everyone, really. There's something in the song. Everyone feels love. Everyone just wants to kind of cry and or whatever. So, you know, rather than someone talking about gangster shit, busting their gats, selling crack on their back, flip flap, clack, you know, you can't really, whatever they're saying, you know, the bling bling, big cars, selling drugs, shooting people, you know, you can't really relate to that if you're from Kensington in London in a sort of private school. So, you know, you like it because it's cool, but you know, you don't feel, you don't relate as much because it's just, you don't sell drugs and you don't kill people. So, or gangbang or whatever. So,
So you referenced this a little bit earlier. So as much as you can talk about it, because I know in this space, a lot of it's hush-hush and secretive. So the Van Gogh project, how did you get involved with it and how much can you share of it?
Okay. I've just done an interview that's coming out. It's just part one's out now on Life and Luxury magazine. And it explains all about this. But I'll talk about it here on Celeb Savant. I met a producer of the film in Cannes. So the Cannes Music Festival that I headlined the show was a week after the film festival. So this producer was there with Johnny Depp at the Cannes Film Festival. And then he came to the music festival and approached me after my show and said, you know, really love the set. And we're doing this movie. And he just found out that Ed had sung Starry Night and had Van Gogh tattooed on him. Thinking we're similar artists, he didn't expect me to be rapping on stage like that. He thought I'd be playing an instrument and singing. So he was like, you know, that was really cool. We were really interested in, we're interested in you being a part of this Van Gogh project. Would you be up for maybe doing a song, a cover of Starry Night, and maybe one original song? So it started there. So we were looking for someone to sing Starry Night. I thought Ed was too, it's not really my style. I was looking more like James Arthur. It'd be too obvious if it was me and Ed doing it.
Yeah.
He probably want to anyway, but even though they're big fans of it. So I was looking at James Arthur and maybe Lucas Graham, or particularly Lewis Capaldi, who I really wanted. That was my first choice. So then it just kind of started growing. And then obviously you introduced me yourself to Macy Gray's management.
Yeah.
Larry, who's amazing. Big up Larry, if you're hearing, and big up Macy too. And then I'd had a remix with Macy that we never met. We had met once actually at a gig in London many years ago, but it wasn't like anything that she would probably remember. And then I started seeing if she wanted to do a song. And then I went to her show in Denmark, met up with her after, and she did this great song called The Heart, which I thought fitted the film. So I submitted it, and they were like, well, do you want to be the album producer of the whole project? So I was like, hell yeah. I'd love that. Like, and it just went from there. And then I got my friend, Ryan, who's from Northern Ireland, who's a brilliant Sewell. He's a brilliant songwriter. I got him involved, and then we're still working on it today. We've got like 10 songs that we're sort of working on. It's very similar to the Elvis biopic, because the Van Gogh, because, you know, he killed himself, committed suicide. He suffered mental health, had schizophrenia. He was very depressed, full of anxiety, big drinker, went to whorehouses and things. So there's a very dark side to his life. And he'd cut his ear off, as everyone knows, really. You know, he's very, very deep and in darks, the darkness as well, because he was so anxious and confused and had psychosis and things. So, yeah, because of his kind of history and things like that, the writer and director of the film, by the name of Kira Seaway, she had a mutual friend who was Dutch and a painter, just like Van Gogh, who committed suicide. So they really want to kind of have this album reach out to, you know, people with mental health, suicidal tendencies, and people that have anxiety and depression. So suicide rate is the highest in men between something like 18 and 34. So if you think about a lot of people that go to the Van Gogh expeditions and you know, art galleries and things, they're a lot older. You know, he's from the 1800s. And so we didn't want to do that style of music for this. It's classical, you know. So we wanted to kind of reach the audience of these people that are suffering and going through this, which is mainly men between 18 and 34. So just like the Elvis biopic, it's not all Elvis. It's got Eminem on the album, for instance. So that was a good reference point that they told me to kind of study, research, and kind of, you know, we want it to reach everyone, and it doesn't have to be music from that era. You know, the film score is slightly different, but the album itself will have, you know, all these great artists on there. So Macy being one of them, and thanks to you for that. Yeah, that's kind of the angle we're going on. So we're reaching a younger audience for the movie and the soundtrack. It's a brilliant film. It's a really, really great script. And it's really kind of passionate. It's kind of, it's all about his pain and suffering, but also the beauty of his painting and his art, and moving to France and going into a mental institution and suffering and more arts. And he just kind of bit, you know, struggling artist with demons. I can relate to him very well. So, and that's what my interview's about, actually. So yeah. So I kind of really relate to the project. I think, you know, he's a lot of people's favorite artists, that, you know, musicians. Tupac Shakur, who's one of my favorite artists, he was a huge fan of Van Gogh, and he wrote a song. So this is a bit of inside info. I spoke with Mopreme Shakur, who's Tupac's brother-in-law, really, and his sister Sakiwa, Tupac's sister. And we have a poem that he wrote to Van Gogh. And it, unfortunately, Tupac's passed away, so we can't read the poem, but we're gonna have one of his family members read the poem. Because it was for Van Gogh, and it's brilliant. You can see it online, so you can just Google Van Gogh poem. But we're gonna get one of the family members, so we're kind of looking at that sort of thing, that style. I've approached Massive Attack, Tracy Chapman, obviously Macy Gray, and all these kind of really cool artists, Lewis Capaldi. So we want to keep it kind of uber cool, but just like relatable to yeah. younger audience. So that's the kind of way we're going. It's going into production this year. There's still kind of casting opportunities for at the moment for they've approached Angelina Jolie to play Van Gogh's mother, and Christian Bale for the father. Also, Johnny Depp's involved as a production level. Him and his best friend, who used to own the club, the Viper Club, the Viper Room that Johnny Depp had in the 90s, where River Phoenix passed away outside.
Yeah,
he was the manager of that at the time. They've been friends ever since, and he's in a producer on the film also. So we've had Johnny Depp from afar, kind of help put this thing together. And Brad Pitt's got a studio in called Maraval. In the south of France, and it's actually not that far from where Van Gogh was institutionalized, where he did the wheat fields paintings and things like that. And it's not actually that far from Cannes. So it's all kind of connected from the Cannes gig, the MiCan. So that's the festa, the music festival. So it's kind of all around that. And this studio that Brad Pitt owns, Maraval, is in the south of France. And he said that we can go and record the album there, which is really exciting. It's a brilliant studio. So that's and that's where we were booking Macy Gray to go in. And I was booked my flights and everything. Everything was booked in for recording with Macy in the south of France. But she got this kidney stone and she was in so much pain. She missed a whole bunch of gigs. And then she had to be back in Berkeley, California for the 1st of December. So we only had a 2-3 day window. So we decided to do it another time. But I hope this spring we can get back out to France and do it at Maraval Studios. It's going to be very exciting.
No, not hope. It will happen.
It will, yeah. If not, she's got a brilliant band that I met in Denmark. She'll record with them in Los Angeles. That's the next, step.
No, well, let's make it full circle and let's... If I would be there, I'd be there as well, just cheering.
Oh, mate, you're welcome here anytime. Anytime you want to come to Europe, England, Denmark, or France. Emil, who's the producer, he's got a house in France and he's got a big yacht, boat. So he invites people over all the time. So
Jethro, we could speak. We're going to have another one to catch up.
We could do a 24-hour interview, couldn't we?
That's why we need to meet, to just hang out and chat. I love chatting with you. So
I'm actually working with a producer from South Africa. Mm-hmm. His name's Gavin Goldberg, and he's in London, and he's helping with the song, the album. Sorry, he's kind of like a bit of a mentor for me. So, his wife's Danish as well. So it's kind of another connection there.
Yeah.
So because I've always wanted to come to South Africa, to, you know, Cape Town, back in when I was modeling when I was younger and not. I'm good looking. everyone went to Cape Town and it wasn't really for the money. It was like to do catalogs because the rand back then was not really doing much. It was like 10 to the pound or something. But it was more for like lifestyle, beautiful, you know, just absolutely stunning pictures that I saw. And also the money you were earning and you spent it in South Africa, you could go out and they were saying, you know, you can get South African wine's lovely. They said you could get a whole meal for two and wine for like £12 back then.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. That's like 120 rand maybe or something. But things are changing now, though, aren't they?
Yeah,
I believe.
Absolutely.
But I'd love to go to Cape Town. Just South Africa, sorry. I mean, you're Durban, are you?
No, Johannesburg. Johannesburg.
Joburg, right.
Yeah.
I get a bit scared when we talk about that. But I've always wanted to go there as well. But I've just seen it's a little bit dangerous.
No, it's fine. It's not so bad.
Is it really? Okay.
Yeah. I've asked you last time and I'll ask you again. I know if I had to ask you each time, and I want to hear our previous interview to hear what you said. 5 songs by other artists that you'd play now once we finish this conversation.
Oh, Fade Into You, Mazzy Star. Natural Mystic, Bob Marley. A song called Scream by Cash Harrison, K. Harrison, which is great. I've been listening to Bonnie Ray, actually, which is If You Don't Love Me. And is that 4?
Yeah.
One more. Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin. So you can just see like my variety of music
in
what I've been listening to recently. So it's interesting, yeah.
The podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message to the listeners, what would you like to say?
I say thanks for listening, firstly, and go out there, get it yourself, you know, go for it, live hard, love strong. That's always been my motto. And if you're an artist, stick to your guns, don't be pigeonholed. If you are independent and signed to a label, make sure you sign your label to their label, not as an artist. That's my my biggest message at the moment is, as an artist, get a label yourself and then sign that label deal to a major, and then you've got full control as the artist, if that makes sense. But yeah, stay happy, stay lots of love. That's my message recently. It's just all love.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.